This WBEZ podcast is supported by The Auditorium, presenting Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater, April 24th through the 26th. Experience the power, passion, and athleticism under the direction of newly appointed artistic director Alicia Graf Mack, plus five Chicago premieres showcasing the bold innovation and artistry that have made Alvin a global cultural treasure. Tickets at auditoriumtheater.org.
This is Tanya Mosley, co-host of Fresh Air. You'll see your favorite actors, directors, and comedians on late-night TV shows or YouTube. But what you get with Fresh Air is a deep dive. Spend some quality time with people like Billie Eilish, Questlove, Ariana Grande, Stephen Colbert, and so many more. We ask questions you won't hear asked anywhere else. Listen to the Fresh Air podcast from NPR and WHYY.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is WBEZ's weekly news recap. Happy fall! We've had so much news this week, and if you missed any of it, don't worry. We're going to get you caught up. Coming up, the Safety Act heads to court.
Two county state's attorneys in Illinois are suing over the so-called Safety Act.
Elections are just around the corner, but will there be anyone to work the polls?
7 weeks to the general election, and there's a critical shortage of poll workers and election judges. The Cook County clerk joining a national effort to recruit military veterans to fill the positions.
And Illinois residents will have to pay for police misconduct.
Chicago taxpayers are on the hook for $25 million to settle lawsuits against Chicago police.
Here to help us make sense of it all is Dan Petrella, state government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Also with us is Aaron Hegarty, City Hall reporter for the Daily Line, and Christian Farr, reporter for NBC5 Chicago. Let's start with statewide news, Dan. Governor Pritzker is calling for the resignation of two state senators. Let's discuss Chicago Democrat Emil Jones III to start off. Remind us who he is and what he's been accused of.
Sure. Emil Jones III is the son of the former Illinois Senate President Emil Jones Jr. He retired from the legislature in 2009, basically handed the seat to his son when he retired through the nomination process. And Emil Jones III was charged earlier this week with federal counts, including bribery and lying to the FBI. He was in court by telephone just now and pleaded not guilty. He is expected to potentially change his plea to guilty later on. The charges involve him accepting allegedly a $5,000 bribe from an executive of a red light camera company to sort of put the brick on a piece of legislation that they didn't like that was moving forward in Springfield. There was also a bribe involved for a second unnamed individual who was somehow involved in the situation.
Interesting. Aaron, do you think that Emil Jones will resign from the Senate?
I have no idea. I mean, I think there's clearly pressure now to resign, but I'm interested to see, you know, obviously, as Dan said, he pled not guilty, but I'm interested to kind of see how this plays out.
What do you think, Christian?
Well, I'm just thinking about all of the aldermen who have also gone down in all of this. There seems to be this focus right now, at least at the federal level, to go after politicians, which didn't seem to happen when I first came here to Chicago about 16 years ago. And so you're seeing some big names like, you know, Patrick Daley Thompson, you know, serving jail time. It'll be interesting to see if he actually is going to end up stepping down. A lot of this corruption has been kind of seeping out right now. So I think you're going to see more names going to be coming out soon.
Let's turn, Dan, to Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings of Southwest Suburban Frankfort. What is he accused of?
This is a somewhat messier situation because he has not been charged with any wrongdoing, but there has been rumblings for a while now about some domestic abuse allegations made by his wife, who he's in the process of going through a divorce with. He has said in court filings that she is conspiring with others to make these things up, to hurt his political career. More recently, it came to light that the state paid $100,000 to settle a lawsuit brought by his former chief of staff, who accused him of some harassment and intimidation, retaliation. Your station reported last week, I believe it was, that a lobbyist and energy or an environmental lobbyist down in Springfield came forward and said that he had been menacing toward her, yelling at her in meetings over legislation, pounding on the table, treating her in very unprofessional ways, and all of that came together in the governor calling for Senator Hastings and Senator Jones, I should note, were both until recently members of the Senate Democratic leadership team to resign their
seats.
Which
complicates things even more. Let's get an update on the governor's race. Christian, some community activists, they've been voicing outrage over Republican Darren Bailey's ads.
Yeah, this is the Super PAC ads that you've probably seen on television, which shows a lot of the Chicago violence from security camera footage, edited all together, very grim. So yesterday, there was a large group of community activists, which included Andrew Holmes, well-known, Father Michael Flager of St. Sabina was there, Purpose Over Pain was there as well, and even those victims of violence were there, some who are portrayed in some of these commercials, very upset. They feel like they're being re-victimized because of these commercials, and they want Darren Bailey to stop supporting these commercials. It's through a super PAC, but he, you know, it's benefiting his campaign. And so they had that protest in front of the Hancock, where Darren Bailey, a supporter, has provided him a place to stay in Chicago. And they have encouraged him to go stay in places like Inglewood, Parkway Gardens. These are notorious places where we see some of the violence and where brown and black individuals who are poor, who are sometimes the victims of this violence, live. And Darren Bailey said in response to that, talking to our political reporter, Marion Ahern, that he doesn't understand why they're being re-victimized, but he is willing to sit down with them. And he's even willing to take up some of those invitations to go to Inglewood, to go to Parkway Gardens, and to spend the night. That's what he said.
Okay.
That's what he told our Marion Ahern.
Okay.
And so we'll see if that indeed happens.
I'd love to see that.
Yeah.
Dandy, you think that'll happen?
I wouldn't place any money on it. I think, you know, we're in a really interesting time in the campaign right now, especially when it comes to all these issues of crime and the accusations that are flying back and forth. The misinformation and disinformation that's out there on these issues is pretty pretty intense.
Speaking of this November 8th election, Cook County Clerk Karen Yarbrough has concerns about how things are going to go on Election Day.
We have a serious shortage of judges and poll workers. Now, the clerk's office manages elections in suburban Cook County, and we've seen our number of election judges shrink significantly in recent years. Over the last 8 years, we've seen a reduction of about 40%.
40% is a big number, Aaron. What do you think is behind this judge shortage?
Yeah, well, as the clerk said, this has kind of been playing out over the past few years. Specifically, there was the 2020 general election right at the beginning of the pandemic, when a lot of people who are usually election judges, seniors mainly, didn't show up or couldn't show up to be election judges because, you know, we didn't know anything about the virus then and they didn't want to compromise their health.
Right.
It's kind of been, there's been trouble getting election judges to kind of get back up to those previous levels now. And, you know, with less than 2 months to go, Karen Yarbrough is urging military veterans to kind of, you know, return to service and serve as election judges. And that says, I think Cook County still needs more than like 2,500 people to adequately cover, you know, the polling places for Election Day. So that's a lot of judges. And, you know, if you don't have enough judges at a polling location, you know, then it's more work for the people there. And, you know, you run the potential risk of not being able to open if no one is there. So I think it's a pretty urgent call. And I think it's something that's happening not just in Cook County, but you know, kind of across
elsewhere.
The country.
Well, my immediate thought was like, is this just a tight labor market or is something more going on?
I don't know. I remember when the primaries were going on and one of the stories we did is that some of these polling places did not open up or didn't open up until like noon or 1 o'clock because they didn't have any judges to, you know, man those most places. And that wasn't just in Chicago. That was also in the suburbs as well. People went back to their typical polling places and found that they weren't open because they didn't have enough people to man those polling places. So, yeah, this is definitely a problem. And, you know, it also is connected to the virus as well.
And, you know, places have like increased pay for election judges. So it doesn't seem like it's even a pay issue. You know, you get paid, I think, like $200 a day in Cook County. But increasing that pay is not drawing, you know, the amount of people who they need to serve as judges.
This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with Chicago Tribune state government reporter Dan Petrella, Aaron Hegarty, City Hall reporter for The Daily Line, and NBC5 Chicago reporter Christian Farr. A reminder that you can now watch the weekly news recap live on the WBEZ Facebook and YouTube pages, and you can leave us a comment or a question. Talk to us in that YouTube chat box, and I might just read your takes on these stories on the air. Now, three state's attorneys have filed lawsuits against Illinois' sweeping criminal justice overhaul. That's known as the Safety Act. It would make Illinois the first state to eliminate cash bail. And here is what McHenry County State's Attorney Patrick Keneally told WTTW.
To many in law enforcement, this was a political ambush. You had legislatures who were sort of in league with a group of activists, many of whom just did not have a comprehensive or good understanding of what the criminal justice system was doing, who took a wish list and put it into legislation. And all of a sudden, at the 11th hour during lame duck session, they sprung this thing. They strong-armed and excluded prosecutors, as well as police, as well as other people involved in the criminal justice system from any type of negotiations. They forced this thing through, and now we're left with the fallout, which is a bill that not only doesn't make sense, but is a clear and present danger to the public.
So he's got a lot to say there, Aaron. This bill was passed back in February of 2021. So thoughts on why it's getting so much attention now?
I think because we have an election coming up and it's an easy target. I think that's...
I see heads nodding in the room.
We were just talking before this how, like, there's plenty of coverage. If you Google it, there's coverage from when this passed. So it's not like this is a new measure. It's not like it's, you know, being thrown on anyone. It's been around for a while.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts, Dan, on the fact that this is coming up and causing quite the stir, right, on social media and elsewhere?
Yeah, I alluded to a little bit earlier the disinformation that's being put out there by some of the same figures behind those super PAC commercials we were talking about earlier. You know, it's hard not to see these lawsuits that have been filed as somewhat politically motivated because the law was passed a year and a half ago. We wrote stories at the time, others wrote stories at the time about some of the questions about how this was going to work to eliminate cash bail, which is the main thing that people have focused on. And, you know, there were months and months for these lawsuits to be brought. You know, I understand one of the state's attorneys, I think it was Mr. Keneally, actually said, you know, he was waiting for some fixes maybe that never came.
Mm-hmm.
But the legislature adjourned in April this year before the June primary, and they haven't been meeting since then. So there's been ample time to file a lawsuit, not less than 2 months before voters go to the polls.
So besides ending cash bail, Dan, give us a summary, if you will, of what else is included in this 764-page bill.
It is really massive. There's provisions that make it easier for citizens to file complaints against the police, not having to sign a sworn affidavit with your name on it. There's another provision that will require every police officer in the state of Illinois to wear a body camera by 2025. Those are some of the top level ones. It's a wide ranging overhaul of the way we deal with criminal justice. And I think rightly so, the elimination of cash bail gets a lot of attention because it is the most substantial change to the way criminal justice operates.
What do you think about that bad rep cash bail is getting, the elimination of it?
I'm getting a ton of text messages.
Are you? Yeah.
About it.
Me too.
Phone
from
calls,
family, elsewhere. From
And again, Stan and Aaron even said, it's a lot of misinformation that is out there. I mean, I'm working on a story with the public defender's office, and they have actually come to me and said, hey, could you please do something more, because there's a lot of misinformation with these commercials. And if you go on social media, you'll see a lot of graphics that have been made that really don't spell out exactly everything that Dan has so eloquently said here. And like he said, there's been stories on this. I mean, you just type it into Google and you'll see that they go back to 2021, and people are just seeing these super PAC commercials. They're paying attention to what's being sent out on social media and not really digging into those credible news sources where you can truly find out what this is all about.
Well, before we take a pause, Christian, I want to jump to a story you reported on this week. You were in West Suburban Lombard covering the man who's finally been released after spending more than 2 years in Taliban hostage.
Yeah, Mark Frericks. He's a contractor. Navy veteran. They've been trying to get him out for some time now. His sister lives in Lombard, and the whole block has really been supporting him and trying to get him out. So Senator Dick Durbin and also Senator Tammy Duckworth have been working on this. Tammy Duckworth, as we know, a military veteran who was injured fighting the war, and she took this as a personal mission to get him out. So he was traded for a drug lord who has been in U.S. custody for more than 15 years. Senator Tammy Duckworth says he's very ill and has been receiving medical care. And so now he can get that medical care from the Taliban by handing him over. And in return, Mark Frericks gets to to come home. We're not certain of his health condition.
And he's in Germany?
As far as I know, he's in Germany on a military base. That's usually where people go. And he's being treated there. And when he's ready to come
home, he can come back.
He will come home. That's what Senator Duckworth told us. But she's very happy, worked very hard with the Biden administration, also had been working with the Trump administration to make this happen.
All right, residents of Lincoln Park, Old Town, and the Gold Coast, they've got a new alderman. Aaron, tell us all about Timmy Knudsen.
They do. So on Monday, Mayor Lori Lightfoot announced that Timmy Knudsen, I guess now former head of the Zoning Board of Appeals, would be the new 43rd Ward alderman. He replaces Michelle Smith, who announced right after the July City Council meeting that she would be retiring, and she left last month. So Knudsen is one of 17 people who applied for this job.
It was a pretty quick replacement.
I don't know. I was on the edge of my seat, so it seemed like it took forever.
I'm like, that was super fast. You're like, right. No, it wasn't.
Yeah. So I believe with his swearing in, he's the youngest member of the city council, taking the place of Alderman Carlos Ramirez Rosa, who I think is older than him by about a year, potentially. He's the seventh member of the city council's LGBTQ caucus. And he noted a few times on Wednesday that he is also the first openly gay mayor, openly gay city council person of the 43rd Ward. He said he wants to use his experiences as a member of the LGBTQ community to, you know, affect change, relate to people. And he's also a lawyer. And he said, you know, he's worked as a grassroots organizer in the 43rd Ward.
Do you have any sense as to why the mayor picked him?
I mean, he was, you know, the head of the Zoning Board of Appeals. It kind of comes with, you know, he's not unknown.
Yeah.
I think he looks like a good choice.
On paper.
And he said, you know, on Wednesday, he has a, quote, you know, proven track record of being, of bringing the private sector results into the public sector, into the public service. And it was kind of funny during his swearing in, you know, aldermen were congratulating him and calling him Tim. And he was very clear that his name is Timmy, not Tim.
Oh, okay.
You know, some aldermen joke that
reporters make notes.
I'm making notes right now.
Yeah. And he was also assigned to his city council committees, which are pretty big, powerful committees since he's just replacing Alderman Michelle Smith. And some aldermen had some kind of qualms with that. Some aldermen who were elected in 2019 who are on kind of more low committees, like this, you know, special events committee.
Yeah.
They said, you know, you're bringing him in and he gets to be on public safety. He gets to make decisions on the budget. Maybe you should reconsider how these committees are signed. So I thought that was kind
interesting.
Of interesting.
And there's going to be an election in February for this ward, for the 43rd ward. After this mayoral appointment, Dan, do you think that it's likely that Knudsen will win?
You know, there's always the advantage of being the incumbent. Your name is in the news for a few months before voters really start turning their attention to those elections. So I think, you know, that's always a little bit of an inherent advantage. I think, you know, unless he screws it up somehow over the next few months, he's probably got a pretty good shot.
Yeah, for sure. And as aldermen are set to receive near 10% salary increases next year, there's a few that are now calling for limiting their pay. Christian, can you imagine asking for a limit on your salary?
My boss could be listening, so I just want to be careful with that.
Dan?
No. I'll be honest. No, I cannot.
The answer is no's all around.
Yeah, No.
I mean, the issue of public official pay is just always
limit. It's not a more vocabulary.
Right. Why are these aldermen doing this, Aaron? Make it make sense.
Well, you know, some I think a lot of aldermen would agree with both of you that they don't want to set a limit on their salary or how much, you know, how big of a raise they can get each year. And that's why, so on Wednesday, there were three proposals introduced relating to aldermanic pay and pay raises. Alderman Greg Mitchell sent two of those measures to the Rules Committee, essentially saying, we're not going to discuss these or vote on these ever or for a long time. One of them was from Alderman Andre Vasquez, who wants to cap aldermanic pay increases at 5% each year. So right now they're tied to CPI, which is why you see this nearly 10% raise. And one issue that Vasquez brought up is right now it's take it or leave it. You either take this massive pay increase, which, you know, right before an election year doesn't look great, or you don't take a raise at all. He wants something kind of in between or to kind of put a cap on pay increases. Another proposal would from Alderman Raymond Lopez, who is also running for mayor. It would reset aldermanic salaries at $120,000 and would provide a 3% pay raise every 4 years. So that's also how long aldermanic terms are.
Okay.
I don't envision anyone voting, latching on to that proposal.
Yeah. That one seems highly unlikely. This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with Aaron Hegarty, City Hall reporter for The Daily Line, NBC5 Chicago reporter Christian Farr, and Dan Petrella, state government reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Reminder, if you're watching us online right now on the WBEZ YouTube page, you can chat with us in the chat box. I might just read your comment or question on the air. Like Angela, who's on YouTube right now, she asks, what do aldermen make now?
It's a range. So not all aldermen make the same amount currently, specifically because you see that aldermen can take their annual pay increase or decline it. So there were, I think, 17 who declined the upcoming pay increase. So right now it's between a little over $120,000 and more than $142,000. So, I mean, it doesn't range that widely, but not everyone makes the same. Some of that is by their own choice. Mm-hmm.
Sticking with you for a bit, Aaron, City Council also approved three police misconduct settlements this week. What is that going to cost taxpayers?
So that's going to cost about $25 million for these settlements alone. The largest was $15 million, which was awarded for the family of Guadalupe Franco Martinez. She was killed in 2020 when a Chicago police squad car crashed into her vehicle near Ashland and Irving Park. Mm. That police vehicle was involved in a high-speed chase. It's just kind of tragic, you know, hearing the family that she left behind. And, you know, police were in pursuit of a person who was wanted for crimes committed, I believe, in the suburbs. When the car hit Martinez's car, it burst into flames and she had to be extricated. The lawsuit was brought by her family, who alleges that police were in the chase, were acting under willful and wanton conduct while driving at the high rates of speed.
$9 million for another one?
Yeah, $9 million for another one. That was a wrongful murder conviction of Patrick Prince. And then probably part of an image that's going to be ingrained in my head for quite some time was a $900,000 payment to settle the lawsuit brought by Dwayne Rollett, who was seriously wounded in 2017 after Chicago police shot him, as they alleged he resisted arrest and that he had a gun. He didn't have a gun, but he had at least one knife with him. And because of that, so this led Alderman Nick Sposato to bring with him to City Hall on City Council floor an example of a knife approximately the same size that Rowlett allegedly had. And so we had an alderman on Wednesday holding a knife on City Council floor.
And that is the visual that you now,
his colleagues to vote against this settlement. So,
yikes.
So, yeah, this is a lot of money for taxpayers, $25 million for just, you know, something that could have been potentially prevented and, you know, aldermen trying to argue against these settlements.
Before I take you out the hot seat for a sec, City Council also approved a measure to protect abortion access. What are the details there?
So this would protect largely people who are coming from out of state for abortion access and gender-affirming care. I think, you know, aldermen and the mayor wanted this to be enshrined in specific language, especially as you see, you know, neighboring states are people from neighboring states have to come to Chicago and Illinois for this care. So they want to ensure that, you know, people can come here and get the care they need and mm-hmm. return to their homes and not be ratted out or
yeah,
punished for coming here.
Well, speaking of neighboring states, Christian, a judge yesterday blocked Indiana's week-old abortion law. So that didn't last very long. What's the latest there?
No, it did not. That was a judge in the Indianapolis area who he blocked it because there had been clinics that had come with a lawsuit to stop this from happening. And so a week ago, we know that it went into effect, and a lot of these clinics, I believe it's about seven of them, very concerned. They shut down operations, actually, even I think believe prior to that. One doctor we talked to was a Katie McHugh, who is from Indiana. She believes in safe abortions, had her own abortion clinic, and was planning to pack up and leave Indiana and just have a small practice in the Indiana area, and was thinking of possibly even moving her whole entire family. You know, she's pleased with this. I didn't get the chance to speak with her after this ban was lifted, but it was reported that, you know, people are getting the word that abortion is now legal again, and people are ready to get their health care that they deserve and that they desire. And, you know, her big thing was she felt that her daughter was losing rights when that ban went into effect. And that ban went very quickly. I mean, that was it was a special session that came in, and within 2 weeks they had put this in place. And so there was a lot of concern. Planned Parenthood had put this lawsuit ahead, and other clinics had latched onto it as well. And so they're pleased right now, but we have to wait and see what's going to happen. I mean, it's just lifted right now, but there's, you know, still more hearings to come, I believe, in October that, you know, could lead to this coming back. So it's going to be a fight.
And this is a good sign, right?
It's a good sign. But even the, you know, anti-abortion people were not even happy with the ban that's in place. To the point that Aaron was bringing up, they don't want people going to other states to get abortions. They want to be able to rat those people out as well. So they want 100% abortion ban. And the one in Indiana was probably somewhere around 98%.
Oh, I see.
You know, because you could still leave the state and get an abortion. And then there's also, you know, other limits and other exclusions for people who can get abortions. So they want a 100%. So not everybody's happy with this. Probably those anti-abortionists who I haven't been able to speak to yet since this ban's been lifted, probably really, really upset now because those abortions can resume.
Do you think that we're going to be hearing more about abortion statewide, Dan, leading up to the election in November?
Absolutely. I think that is what Democrats have identified as one of the top winning issues for them with voters in November, especially with all that's swirling around on crime and the new issues of corruption that they have to deal with. You know, you look to the referendum that happened in Kansas in the primary earlier this summer, where voters in a pretty deep red conservative state rejected an amendment to the state constitution that would have allowed lawmakers to enact an abortion ban. You look at some of the other special elections, like the one in Alaska and New York, that have taken place where pro-abortion rights candidates have performed much better than people expected. I think this is really a very winning issue. Even if we go back to Senator Hastings, who we discussed earlier, and his response to Governor Pritzker calling for his resignation yesterday was, you know, it's up to the voters to decide my fate, and they should elect, you know, me, a longtime, you know, Army veteran, a longtime senator, and somebody who was going to defend a woman's right to choose. So you can just see, you know, one of the things I'm watching to see is whether, you mentioned the special session in Indiana, whether Illinois ever gets around to having the special
session that they
said they were going to have back on the day that the decision came down.
Almost
from the Supreme
forgot
Court.
About
yes.
that.
I think they're hoping that people will have forgotten that they said that was going to happen.
Yeah. You know what? The police misconduct settlements that we were just talking about a moment ago, Aaron, we got a question on YouTube from Sarah Berger. She says, why can't that lawsuit money come from police pensions?
I don't know.
That's a great question. But
that $25 million, she says, could help a lot of communities.
Yeah.
It could.
Good point. Yeah. It's a good thought. Yeah.
That's actually interesting, if I may interject.
Oh, for sure.
It goes back to the Safety Act earlier, because one of the things that they were talking about while that was being debated in the legislature was eliminating something called qualified immunity, which protects mm-hmm. police officers from being the target individually of civil lawsuits.
Yeah.
And opponents of the bill managed to get that taken out before it was passed. So that just goes to show that there was some negotiation, there was some give and take on that bill, despite what the critics are saying now.
The union movement continued to gain momentum in Chicago this week. I want to listen to a clip here of Christy McGuire, who's an adjunct faculty member at the School of the Art Institute.
More than 600 of us are forming our union with Art Institute of Chicago Workers United, what we call ACWU, part of AFSCME, building on the incredible work of our staff colleagues at the school and the museum.
Christian, unionization efforts seem to be growing across the country.
Yeah, I mean, this is a non-tenured faculty calling on this union, as you just heard right there. 600 adjunct professors and lecturers at the school. They signed that union authorization cards, and members of faculty organizing committee said Wednesday in a letter addressed to the school's president. And they're really pushing for this. You know, they yeah. you know, want, you know, fair labor. They want protections. You know, things of that nature. They're teaching these classes. They have an expertise, and they want to be treated fairly. So they had that big rally on Wednesday. But yeah, there is a big movement in this country that's going on, and they've, you know, have support. But we'll have to see what's going to.
Were you at the rally?
I was not at the rally. I've been at plenty of rallies this week. This wasn't one of them.
You've been very busy this week. Well, right up the street from the Art Institute on Michigan Avenue, Trump Tower. That was also in the news. And it was included in the New York Attorney General's fraud lawsuit against Trump and his kids. So, Dan, what's the former president accused of doing
so now? The Trump Tower, which is right across the street from where we used to live at the Tribune, it is an example in the lawsuit of how Trump manipulated, allegedly, the values of his properties for, on the one side, inflating them or using their real values to get loans. And then when it came to tax time, reporting that they were essentially worthless so that he didn't have to pay taxes on them. The problem is that he left the Trump Tower here in Chicago off of some financial disclosures to sort of allegedly hide their value from regulators, from banks that he was asking for loans, things like that. Mm-hmm. So it was just one example, I think, in the lawsuit of a pattern of how they've allegedly manipulated the values of these properties to their benefit.
I can't believe how much I'm still hearing Donald Trump's name. And as we sit in the studio right now and I look up at the television, what's on CNN right now, I'm seeing his name at the bottom of the screen. Over to Chicago's West Side, Christian, an explosion at an Austin apartment building injured 8 people. What happened? Do we know yet?
No, we don't know. We're still trying to figure out exactly. And when you look at the building, a majority of it below is intact. So
yeah,
something
and then
imploded
it just
inside.
Shattered at the top.
Yeah, blew out the windows. I mean, you could see shards that are kind of stuck into the building across the street. There was a letter carrier. He wasn't delivering mail. He actually lives in that building. He was injured. Shabron Robinson was injured in that blast. And according to the union president for letter carriers, he said that he's in pretty bad shape. He's got burns over a majority of his body. And then residents were allowed to go back into the building the day after just for 30 minutes to grab a few things. But, you know, what's next for them? Because they can't go. There are certain buildings they just can't go back into. They're not structurally sound or safe. And so now they've got to find a new place to live, and they don't have anything because all of their items are inside of that apartment.
So where are they now? They're just kind of staying with
some are staying with friends and family. Down the street, there's Circle Urban Ministries that is helping them out. The landlord is also providing them with housing as well, in some cases permanent, in some cases temporary. So there is an effort to help these people. But again, if you've collected things, we all have. We have homes. Mm-hmm. You know, imagine your home being decimated.
I was just going to ask these two. I mean, yeah. Did you see images of this explosion?
Yeah, I can't imagine what that experience is like. And that's one of my biggest fears, is like waking up to a fire, let alone an explosion. That's jarring.
I have that same fear too, Aaron.
Yeah, just traumatic.
I think we all have that same fear. I think that's natural.
Safe to say, for sure. This is Reset. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We are going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap with Chicago Tribune state government reporter Dan Petrella, Aaron Hegarty, who's a City Hall reporter for the Daily Line, and NBC5 Chicago reporter Christian Farr. Police shut down traffic in downtown Chicago over last weekend, blocking cars that were celebrating Mexican Independence Day from entering part of downtown. What did the city and police say was behind that decision, Aaron?
Yeah, so this was from like, I wasn't following this as it was happening, but looking back, I think it was from like 11 p.m. Saturday to like 2:30 a.m. Sunday. So it wasn't even for that long. And I think there were some like unintended consequences, as there always are with, you know, shutting down the downtown, where people maybe we're stuck in downtown then. You don't want people downtown, but you're also kind of trapping people downtown. And this was after, you know, they said there was the kind of flooding of downtown to celebrate Mexican Independence Day Friday night. And then they said, police said, you know, they responded to a couple shootings and a carjacking downtown. And so they made the announcement that they were going to, you know, do the shutdown. And I think it's not just like downtown as we think about it. It's, I read that it extended all the way south to like 18th Street. So, I don't know.
I was downtown a little bit on Friday, and I was kind of caught in the middle of the excitement, the horn honking and the flags waving. And I was like, this is great. Got home later on and saw what else had occurred.
Yeah. And I don't know how you measure the effectiveness of shutting down the downtown. Like, was it effective? Was it not?
Well, the police just didn't seem like they were doing much. They just were just on the side. Every SUV I saw was just kind of parked on the side. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess you're just taking part in the festivities then, or just spectating.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know it's a very unpopular move that the mayor has kind of pulled multiple times before.
Multiple times.
Yeah. I was going to say, going back to the protests and some of the problems that spun out of those back in 2020.
Yeah. It was tough to navigate trying to cover that. I mean, we didn't know what exits we could use and to get around.
So going back to our Austin story, the explosion, looks like the Chicago Tribune is reporting that one person has died.
Wow. I wouldn't be surprised.
This is breaking, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, you have to go out there and really
see it.
You can just kind of see the roof was just, you know, almost completely blown off. And so you could see the workers in there. It's just unbelievable.
Wow. I want to move to a very different story. Kind of also a sad note here. This is over in North Suburban Evanston, Christian. Police were investigating a body that was found at the local high school.
Yeah, my neck of the woods, actually. My kids go to school in Evanston Public School District. This is a completely separate school district. But yes, they on Tuesday, September 20th, they found an adult woman, a 63-year-old woman's body. At the school, they determined that she was not connected to the school in any way, and they have ruled it a suicide. But of course, that brings up a lot of concern. You know, what's going on? Why did it happen on campus? And so they were just she was on the field. So just, you know, trying to allay concerns, and they actually, I believe, had put out on their website that we recognize that anytime there's a police investigation on the ETHS campus, it may cause strong reaction. We're to support our student staff. Students may also reach out to their social worker if they express distress or desire support. And this is very important because there was an incident months ago where a gun was found inside of the school. There were some kids with a gun. Same school, ETHS, and it caused a lockdown. You know, parents rush to the school. The kids are all locked inside and, you know, they're trying to figure out what's going on. Eventually, they let those kids out. No one was injured. These kids had been in the bathroom playing around with a gun. Luckily, no one was hurt. And I'm not certain if charges came from that. But, you know, anytime this, you know, something with a school with this magnitude, you know, there's definitely concern.
I mean, just as a CPS parent, I'm already just nervous, just a parent period, just in these times, I'm just nervous about, you know, my kids going out to school every day, much less having specific incidents happening on their campus that I could point to that are just going to fuel the, you know, the fears within me.
Same thing here. I mean, my kid's school is right around the corner from
where this happened.
And her school was on a soft lockdown when all this happened. So, you know.
Yeah. That's sad. I want to check on our YouTubers and see what they're saying. It looks like there's still a lot of chatter right now about the Mexican Independence Day parade and celebrations. Sarah Berger loves seeing the Mexican flags flying for their independence. Larkin Johnson says about this parade, how is it legal for them to shut down that large of an area on such short notice?
I don't know. I mean, they did it. I'd never seen them. I mean, I've been here for protests and they never shut the city down. But yeah. when the George Floyd happened, that's when you really started to see, you know, them bringing the big, you know, salt trucks out and blocking exits. And so it just became very difficult to get in and out of the city.
Yeah. Shamrock Bloom says, let them have a parade.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, it's exciting. It's fun.
Let them celebrate.
Yeah. I mean, they were celebrating. I saw them. I worked Sunday and I saw cars driving around Sunday afternoon. So it's great to see it.
So we're starting to wrap up the recap. I'm wondering what stories really stuck out to you folks this week. Maybe something that surprised you, something that you thought was underreported. Start with you, Dan.
I might put in actually a shameless plug for a project that a couple of my colleagues launched this week.
Go right ahead.
I listened to the first episode of the Tylenol Murders podcast that my colleagues Christy Gutowski and Stacey St. Clair have been working on for a while now. Last night while I was loading the dishwasher and I was hooked. You know, this was an incident that happened in the suburbs where I'm from originally, just a couple years before I was born. And I'm really looking forward to finding out what they've uncovered in this work that they've been doing, I think, for about a year now.
Nice. What about you, Aaron?
I've listened to both episodes of that podcast, and I am ready for
Are
the
you
next
a fan?
One. I'm
good.
A fan.
Good, good.
So this reporting from Cranes that the mayor's Invest Southwest program is largely just something that's been envisioned where not one project in this Invest Southwest program has had construction start in the past 3 years.
You know what? That is right.
And it's interesting to me because it's something that the mayor always points to. This is her, like, banner program.
Absolutely.
And sure, there's a pandemic, but that's something that really stuck with me.
We need movement. Yeah. We need action. What about you, Christian?
You know, at NBC Chicago, we are profiling a lot of people during Hispanic Heritage Month. So just to go off a little bit from all the major news stories that are going on, I had the opportunity to do one of those stories about a young woman who's a second-year medical student, UIC's first DACA medical student. And she's had a lot of uphill battles. She's a product of the community colleges here in the state of Illinois. Her name is Estefania Perez Luna. She's an amazing woman who received an award several weeks ago. And she's just a story of inspiration. I think her parents have no more than a fifth grade education, probably even lower than that. But she was able to get through her undergrad and is now in medical school, made it through her first year in medical school.
That's wonderful.
Is now working on her second year. And she wants to be an advocate. She's an advocate right now at Community Health, which is a clinic that's been around for more than four decades. And she holds classes on the weekends where she tells people about diabetes and preventative health care. So it's just a fantastic story. Every once in a while we get to do those, but
You
got to do the regular news as
Love
well.
Love that. Mm-hmm. That is NBC 5's Christian Farr, the Chicago Tribune's Dan Petrella, and the Daily Line's Aaron Hegarty. Thank you all so much for joining. Have a great weekend.
You too.
You as well.
You too. Thanks.
This episode of Reset was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Andrew Merriweather. Want to always stay up to date with the news? Then you're in the right place. Go ahead and subscribe to Reset to always get your weekly news recap in your feed. And when you subscribe, don't forget to leave us a rating. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend.
WBEZ has a stacked lineup of events this spring with must-see musicians like Patti Smith and Ani DiFranco and compelling authors like Patrick Radden Keefe along with Gillian Flynn. For more, go to wbez.org/events.